Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Tortoise.
Hello, I'm Giles Whittell. I'm Tortoise's deputy editor. It's the week beginning Monday, the 8th of April. From Tortoise, welcome to the news meeting.
Millions of people across North America will witness at least a partial solar eclipse on Monday.
Residents from the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis have started to return home after the Israel Defense Forces say they have withdrawn all of its maneuvering ground forces.
Thames Water has apologized for these ongoing issues.
A poor record on leaks and on sewage contamination.
After 352 days, Russ Cook is completing his extraordinary endeavor, running the length of Africa.
To help me work out what should lead the news, I'm joined by Tortoise's climate editor, Jeevan Vasagar. Hi, Jeevan.
Hi, Giles.
By our reporter, Stephen Armstrong. Hello.
Hello.
And Bronwyn Maddox, director and chief executive of Chatham House, the International Affairs Policy Institute. Bronwyn was formerly foreign editor of The Times, and in that role, my boss.
Hi, great to be with you.
Now, Bronwyn, this is not your first rodeo, because Well, you've done this before, but you also host Chatham House's weekly podcast, Independent Thinking, episodes of which are released each Friday. And the last one was about Turkey after the recent local elections there. So briefly, Bronwyn, how do you decide what to talk about in that podcast?
That is a really good question. We look at what is happening in the news, but we also look at what is happening more generally and what we think should be in the news. And Turkey, and as we're doing this week, Sudan, has Sudan fallen below the radar? Really very, very nasty conflict still happening there. We look at some of the things that we want to talk about that we feel should be in the news. But there does need to be a justification for each one being really relevant to that week.
Oh, well, fascinating. Well, check that one out wherever you listen to podcasts. Now let's get started with the news meeting. With long stories short, so in a headline or a sentence, you have to tell us what story you think should lead the news. Bronwyn, you go first.
Well, the US, Joe Biden, and the UK, in the person of Lord Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, are leaning hard on Israel to say our support is not unconditional. Don't go into Rafah without a plan to save civilians' lives.
Okay, thank you. Jeevan, what's your long story short?
Charles, my long story short is the shit hits the fan.
It just goes on and on, doesn't it? I think I know what that's about. Stephen.
And Moses stretched forth his hand towards heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land.
I think this is very, very timely, if not necessarily a shoo-in for the top of the news. Okay. So let's start with the meaty stuff. Bronwyn, if you want to go first, if I'm not much mistaken, what we're talking about here is slipping Western support for Israel. Tell us more about it.
We've just passed the six-month point since the awful Hamas attacks on Israel of October the 7th, and countries that support Israel have been getting more and more uncomfortable in response to lots and lots of protests around the world at the death toll of civilians in Gaza and the sheer destruction of Gaza. And both the US and the UK have come out in different ways now and said, look, to Israel, you cannot count on our support forever. You get actually a wall of comments and commentary for what that's worth from people beginning, I am a friend of Israel, but this must stop. And it seems to me this is putting a lot of pressure on Israel to try and do a deal New diplomacy has started again this week in Egypt, try and get the hostages out, and for Israel to come up with a plan to save civilian lives. Israel says we haven't finished the military operation, we haven't got the Hamas leaders, but still, it may not have the freedom that it has had over the past 6 months just to continue going. And I think that we're coming to the point where decisions need to be taken. Things probably cannot go on for Israel as they have been.
Have we come to the point where the theory has actually been tested that if the Biden administration wants to, it can force the issue? I mean, last week we understood that there was a fairly rapid response to Biden's outrage, was the word he used, at the killing of aid workers on the coast road, following which Netanyahu, if I'm not mistaken, well, I mean, a few days later, he's announced this morning the withdrawal of some troops from Khan Yunis. Is there cause and effect there, or is there in fact a ruptured relationship where, in which even the President of the United States cannot be sure that if he pulls a lever, there'll be a result?
The President of the US cannot be sure that there will be a result, but I do think, as you've described it, that the withdrawal of some Israeli troops and the way in which that was presented does reflect a grudging concession to US pressure. But we don't know. Joe Biden does not know that if he really, really said, look, we're cutting off arms sales to Israel, what the response would be from this government or indeed any government that replaces it in Israel.
What's your peg here? Is it the 6 month anniversary, or is it the events of last week where we had simultaneously the killing of those aid workers, we had a strike on Damascus, and we had uptick in pressure, as you say, from both US and the UK? The only difficulty in deciding whether to put this at the top of the page, as it were, is the incremental nature of the story. It's bit by bit, isn't it? All these factors are moving on every day. What's your stand first?
It's that negotiations are going on right now, this week, in Egypt, and senior Americans have flown in to try to accelerate those negotiations. So things are moving this week. Israel is going to have to take a decision this week about whether or not to go into Rafah. And we've had these twin statements from Joe Biden and David Cameron at the weekend, putting pressure on Israel. So the thing that is looming is an Israeli decision, which fork of the road to go down.
Okay, very clear. Stephen, what do you make of this, of the salience and the sort of substance of this story? Do you feel that, to Broman's last point there, that it, now more than in preceding weeks, it's make your mind up time for Israel?
I do. And some of that pressure is also internal. I think that's another thing that's important to point out, that yesterday there was a huge rally with hostage families, some 50,000 people gathered making speeches, and they were calling for elections and calling for Netanyahu to step down. So Netanyahu's dealing with this rising tide of anti-Netanyahu feeling. And I think that probably ties his hands, well, no, less ties his hands, but makes that decision even more critical. He's facing, how does this play at home? How does it play internationally? And it's clearly a crucial week for him.
Jeevan, thoughts?
I think Bronwyn makes a really persuasive case, Giles, and I think the weakening of Western support is really interesting. My question about this story, and I think the question that probably determines whether it leads or not, is whether the weakening of support relates to arms exports to Israel. And I think the answer to that question is no, it won't change that. And if it doesn't change that, I think Gaza is obviously one of the two most important stories in the world right now. But there are other elements that I think Bronwyn identifies which are more compelling to me, and that is what is happening to the Hamas leadership, what is happening to hostages. But I think most importantly for me, what is happening on the ground in Gaza. We've talked about the Israelis withdrawing from Khan Yunis. Who takes over there? What is the vacuum that's developing? Can aid be delivered in this vacuum? Those are the questions that I want answered.
Great. Jeevan, tell us about the shit.
So what's just happened is that Thames Water's parent company, Kemble, has said that it can't service its debt. It can't make an interest payment that is due this month. So this looks like it's the end game kind of financially for Thames Water. But just a bit of background. So over the last couple of years, as we all know, Britain has been getting wetter, hotter, we've been impacted by climate change. The impact of a wetter country is that more sewage is basically kind of washed into our rivers. Thames Water and other companies have underinvested in the sewage system. So that's a crisis that's kind of unfolding at the moment. Also, our population has been increasing. So there are just more of us putting more pressure on these services. But I think the kind of key point, the thing that I'm pitching today, is a story about the finances of Thames Water. And the really extraordinary thing that's happened here. So basically, water companies should be really, really boring, right? We shouldn't care about them at all. What they exist for, what Thames Water exists for, is to supply a monopoly service to 16 million people in London and the Thames Valley. They pay their bills. It fixes the pipes. It makes a small profit on top. It's small, steady. That's how it goes. What actually happened at Thames Water, particularly under the ownership of an Australian investment bank called Macquarie from 2006 to 2017, is an extraordinary act of financial engineering. So the owners of Thames Water in that period basically raised vast quantities of debt. And it extracted value through the debt, and then dividends floated up through the system to service the debt. And what's happened now is that Ofwat, the water regulator, which basically appears to have been asleep at the wheel for the last several years, has now said that it's a condition of your license, that if you're paying a dividend, you have to meet certain standards in terms of customer service, in terms of your impact on the environment. And so they're unable to send these dividends up to the parent company to make their payments. So basically, we're now in a kind of standoff. So Macquarie, the Australian bank, has ridden off into the sunset, I should add in a footnote here. They're fine. But the parent company, the owners of that parent company, have said, well, we can't make this interest payment. And so the question is, what happens next? So do the people who are owed money by Thames Water, do they blink? Do they say, we'll amend the terms of what we're owed, or we'll take some equity in this company? Does the government step in to nationalize it? So we just don't know what will happen next. So that's why I'm pitching it. I'm pitching it as a story about this crazy, insanely financially engineered company, how it's kind of come to the brink of a crisis, and how there are all these questions about what's going to happen now and who's going to take charge of it. Who's going to fix this mess?
Two questions. Do we know, what did Macquarie say it was raising the debt for? I'm sorry, that's like an ignoramus's question about what the financial engineering was all about.
Well, this is a standard kind of private equity model, basically. You raise a lot of money through debt. Macquarie said, they are, one of the biggest, perhaps the biggest infrastructure investor in the world, in Europe. And their standard operating procedure is to raise a lot of money through debt, to take a lot of money out. It's all perfectly legitimate, all within the rules. They said they did invest. They looked after the business. The question is whether they invested enough. It doesn't look like they did invest enough. There's nothing illegitimate. There's nothing unlawful about what they did. But it did lead to the situation in which Thames Water at one point had debt that was at 80% of the value of its assets. So if you sold off, the entire business, the value of it, the debt would account for, would be equivalent to 80% of that. That's an extraordinary level of gearing. But it is not unusual, Giles. It is not unusual that in private equity-owned infrastructure this happens. It's also happened in other water utilities. It's also happened in other power utilities. There is more pressure on interest payments now across the board. Interest rates are rising. It's harder to service your debts. You will notice this if you have a mortgage yourself. We're all in this situation where the tide is going out and the weakest are being exposed.
Bronwyn, this isn't strictly international affairs, but the Macquarie involvement, I guess, makes it so. What's your general take on whether it's fair to expect a big, as Jeevan says, boring utility to take a much longer term view than, say, politicians would and invest for a future with climate change?
It's completely reasonable. And it's fine, I'll talk about anything, but also used to, way back in the day, the Financial Times write particularly about the privatized utilities when all this regime was starting up. And I think the regulator has not just been asleep, but been misguided about the way it allowed these companies, using the flow of water, flow of money from customers' bills, allowed them to become very highly geared in the jargon, a lot of debt piled on them by private equity firms or whatever, rather than putting that money into investment. I'm thinking of a paper that Dieter Helm, a well-known economist specializing in the sector, has just put out saying, look, this has been a 30-year loss of a chance to rebuild Britain's water and electricity sectors. And a lot of that money needed to go in. The regulator did not have to say, yes, you can, financial companies, take all these dividends out and leave the companies with loads of debt. It could have imposed all kinds of conditions about investment. So to me, the thing that I'm not going to be advocating Jeevan's story for him, but the thing that makes it really pacey at the moment is the immediate need for a decision by the government and the regulator of do they let the current owners of Thames Water just do they let the current company go bust and a new company take over without the debt, take over Thames Water and take it on from there.
Jeevan, you wrote about this for us last week. Am I right that there's a potential wrinkle in this, in that one of those institutional shareholders is the University Lecturers Union? And does that make any difference to anything?
That's right. So they're one of the, it's primarily in foreign ownership, but the USS, the Lecturers Pension Fund, has a big stake in it. I mean, it's worth remembering that all of these institutional investors are vast organisations, vast pools of money. Thames Water is a very small portion of their assets overall.
Stephen, how angry are you about the quality of Thames Water and how do you rate the story as a journalist?
I'm very angry because I live about, I don't know, you could throw a stone to the Thames from my house if you threw really far.
Lucky you.
Yeah, we can't see it. There's buildings in the way, so you have to throw it very high. Otherwise, your neighbours get angry. And so this is literally a problem that's on my doorstep. And when the flooding starts, I go, London is drowning, and I do live by the river. But I think there's one time distance that Bronwyn talked about, which was 30 years that we've lost. And actually, to some extent, this story needs to be considered in terms of time. Because if we cast forward 30 years, that's about the time that the Environment Agency has warned that England will run out of water, that the amount of water we're gathering will be less than our needs, and England will start to enter sort of drought conditions. Scotland, not so much. Scotland has something like 80% of the whole country's drinking water. And that's when you start to think that maybe it's even the idea of regional water companies is archaic. We're in a situation now where the idea of these small profitable units managing such an essential supply is something that's really 20th century. And we can no longer consider water as being something that we mess around with in this way. What we need is a national strategy to understand how we're going to deal in the long term with the effects of climate change and ensuring our water supply.
Picking up on that point of England running out of water, Jeevan, can you clarify this? Doesn't mean it will have stopped raining. In fact, my understanding of climate change is that the atmosphere will be warmer and wetter. It'll be that we don't have the infrastructure to collect the water that we need. Is that right?
So the question is the relationship between the rising demand for water from a growing population, a more affluent population, and the provision of clean water, the provision of sanitation services. And there is a line where those two things cross over, and there is a question about whether we can supply clean water to the number of people who need it if we don't invest. And the amount of investment that's needed is vast.
Okay. Jeevan, thank you very much for that. Let's take a break, and then we'll hear what Stephen thinks should lead the news.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Stephen, tell us about your story.
Well, Giles, the reason I think you need to use this story is that it is the Omni story. In this story, all of the stories in the world today are gathered together. It is, of course, the solar eclipse, which is transiting essentially mainly the United States. The fun part is the United States. It will be visible from parts of Western Scotland, but only about 22% eclipse. But there is a band across the US where there will be something like 4 minutes of total darkness, hence Moses. But also Moses, because...
What do you mean, hence Moses?
I gave you the long story short, which is a quote from Genesis, where it was the sixth of the plagues that Moses brought down upon the land of Egypt, as we all know. So certainly the people who do know are the conspiracy theorists on the right in America who have... basically, amongst other things, warned that there will be Masonic sacrifices. That's Alex Jones, bless his heart. That there will be states of emergency declared. It will be a time for the government to put into practice its ways of controlling the population. And that the whole thing is a very sinister plot. In particular, it's a sinister plot because NASA, bless their hearts, like to have fun with their acronyms. So amongst NASA's acronyms are obviously Calypso, CARV, CATS, Artemis, and my favourite, TESS, which is Transit Exoplanet Survey Satellite. TESS is also the name of my younger daughter. But in the case of the rockets that NASA are sending up to record the effects of the eclipse, they've called it APEP. Now, deliberately so, APEP is also the name of the Egyptian snake god that will devour the sun at the end of the world in Egyptian mythology.
Can I just be clear about one thing before we go any further? The conspiracy theorists are not alleging that NASA or the world government has somehow contrived the eclipse. They are suggesting that there are nefarious forces and the globalists are going to take advantage of it.
Well, there is a British conspiracy theorist who believes that it's all too much of a coincidence and is therefore implying that the entire eclipse event is a little bit more sinister than just an eclipse event. But as far as I can tell, that's only one.
Okay. So this is the Omni story, and why is it...
I haven't quite finished.
Yeah.
Yes. So Apep is the Egyptian god that will devour the sun and tip into effect the apocalypse. As it happens, that also coincides with the arrival of some red heifers in Israel, which has been bought by a group of Israelis who are planning the Third Temple. And they are planning to sacrifice the red heifers, which is, in Jewish tradition, the ritual that will allow the Third Temple to be built. And in American evangelical traditions, some circles, it also will tip over the apocalypse. And so has also been rumours that that's why Hamas attacked on the 7th of October was to prevent the sacrifice of the red heifers and the building of the Third Temple. So it gets better. Also today, and this is the real reason I'm pitching the story, CERN is switching on the Large Hadron Collider. Also, Mount Etna is puffing out smoke rings. Now, if you want an apocalypse, you got an apocalypse. Like the God Particle, the end of the world, Mount Etna spewing up smoke rings, red heifers being sacrificed, the snake god eating the moon. So I say this is the story for you.
It seems to me that you're almost pitching this just for the colour of the theories. I thought you were going to be deadly serious and say this shows us. You recall last week, we had someone, a guest, pitch the story of the container ship that hit the Baltimore Bridge, not because of the accident, but because of the conspiracy theorists that attached to it. And we've got Marjorie Taylor Greene, an elected House Republican, issuing warnings to her 8 million followers that the globalists are going to take advantage of us.
I mean, there is that said, and it is I mean, there was a moment in August 2017 where there was another solar eclipse, and Donald Trump refused to accept the scientific advice on how he should deal with the solar eclipse. And he looked up into the sky, as his advisor said, don't look into the sky, don't look into the sky. So that's the beginning. At that point, it was still acceptable to have that debate about the science, and that no one believed that it was eating the world. Something has happened since 2017 that we're now in a situation where that is normal. But because I was there on the Elizabeth Day podcast, I felt if I did exactly the same story, you might reject it on the grounds of repetition. But that is really the point, isn't it? It's that we've reached such distrust of science in certain parts of the world that the idea of exploring the fundamental nature of the universe through CERN is tied into an eclipse. And instead of saying this is a really interesting time in geology, astronomy and physics, what we say is it's definitely the end of the world. And I think that's a bad state of mind for humanity to be in.
Bronwyn, are you at all concerned about the way in which the United States is marking this eclipse?
Yes, it goes. It's more evidence, if you like, of the skepticism about science that Stephen was just talking about, though that does go back forever. If you like, I'm thinking of all the caricatures of the mad scientist and everything. But you know, the US seems particularly prone to this dispute about what facts and evidence are really, really worth. It bothers me as a news story, though. It's irresistible, except it's surely a very short lifespan. And it's sometime in the middle of the night, UK time. Most of these conspiracy theories will be disproved and will, you know, roll on tomorrow, and maybe Etna's still puffing away, but that's about it. All these things will not have happened. And then I do worry about giving airtime, however entertaining it is to say red heifers and snake gods eating the moon, which it is, that giving airtime to this just gives it more credence than it should have. It's a fabulous story, though.
Jeevan, what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's everything and nothing, isn't it? It's either it's sort of the alpha. If it, you know, if this happens and it's the end of the world, it's clearly the alpha and the omega of your news bulletin, Charles. And if it doesn't, it isn't. I think I'm very interested in information ecosystems, in where people get their information from, why people believe the things that they believe, who makes money out of this. I think the problem. Bronwyn put her finger on the problem, which is if you as a news editor commission an investigation into conspiracy theories and you peg it to the eclipse, the first thing your readers think is, oh no, that, yeah, none of those things happened, you know, and they switch off. So you need to peg it to something that is timeless in some way.
Those are the stories. Now you have to tell me which ones you think should lead, but you're not allowed to choose your own. So just to recap, we'll use a shorthand of red heifers and the eclipse, the shitstorm, and declining Western support for Israel. Bronwyn, you cannot choose the latter. Which of the other two do you have at the top of the bulletin?
I'm going to go for Thames Water. And actually, even I put it over my own because I think your challenge, I don't know if that's within the rules, but I think your challenge about the incremental nature of the story in Gaza is right. And while I do think this could be a significant week, it may not. Whereas this indisputably is a significant week for Thames Water. It's just defaulted on its payments. The government has to make this crucial decision, which will set the principles of the water industry and whether it's going to get new investments. So I put that one. I must say, not when the Hadron Collider switches on, but when it finds something. I would then make a very good argument for that. I think Stephen's absolutely right, but it hasn't found anything yet. They're just pressing the on button.
It is a rare show of double magnanimity from a guest competitor. Thank you, Bronwyn. Jeevan, which one would you put at the top?
I'd lead with Gaza, I would say, because I think even if there's a fractional reduction in Western support for Israel, I think it's interesting. I'd like to see it reported out, and I want to know what consequences it has.
Stephen.
I'm very aware that I have delivered the drop the red heifer story, so I am going to drop it and go for the Thames Water story, because I think it is... It's really important as well, I think, to report it with the wider ramifications, to look at whether private equity should be allowed to own critical infrastructure. What are we going to do about water for the next 30 years? I think it's an enormous story.
OK, thank you all very much. Here is what I think. I obviously love the eclipse story, but I've never heard a more devastating analysis. One would expect nothing less from Bronwyn as a former foreign editor of the time limitedness of your story. It is over. It reminds me of that episode. It's over, you know, tonight. It reminds me of that episode of Parks and Rec where they sit with the flat earthers or the cult followers in the park and approach yet another deadline for the end of the world, and it doesn't come, and they all slope off a little bit disconsolate. Also, I've noticed that this blockbuster Alex Garland film, Civil War, opens in cinemas later this week, and I do wonder whether the studio timed that to coincide.
It's pretty much perfect, isn't it?
They certainly got the zeitgeist, but that ranks third in the running order. Unlike Jeevan and Bronwyn, I am going to rank the Thames Waters story second because everybody continues to get their water and sewage story services. I do think it is important for all the reasons you explain, and I'm struck, I'm not completely convinced that it's relevant, but I'm struck by the comparison between the chronic underinvestment by Thames Water over its period of responsibility with some really amazing civil engineering projects that other utilities all over the world have undertaken at huge expense to prepare for climate change or just to prepare or just to do their job. So if you live in California, as I once did, the storm drains built in this semi-desert for the very rare occurrences that could threaten cities are colossal. If you live in Chamonix or Saint-Gervais-les-Bains in France, you will see above your town a huge concrete installation built for the one event that they forecast as a result of climate change when the glacier above collapsed and they have to catch it to save the town. That is proper planning, isn't it? And that's what hasn't happened here. And that, by the way, is how I would run the story with lots of lovely pictures of concrete storm drains. But I think actually, Bronwyn, you did make the case for the Thames story and the Gaza story are make your mind up stories. And I think you did make the case for the fact that just as it's make your mind up time for the UK government and Thames Water, it is also make your mind up time this week for the Israeli government as to whether they will lean into the talks in Cairo, whether they will lean in militarily in Rafah. And so I think a story that sets all that up is the one that should lead the news. That's it for this episode of the News Meeting. If you think there's a story we missed, and God knows we covered most of them, then you can email us on newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. Stephen and Jeevan, thank you both very much. And Bronwyn, thank you especially for joining us. We look forward to listening to the next episode of Independent Thinking on Friday. We've had the one on Turkey, and the next one, remind us, is on
Sudan and why people shouldn't forget it.
Indeed. Okay, so we'll be listening to that and back with another episode of the News Meeting shortly. Until then, thank you very much.
Tortoise.
I'm David Baddiel. I'm a writer and a comedian and a Jew.
I'm Saeeda Varsi. I'm a businesswoman and a politician and a Muslim.
Jews and Muslims always seem to be in the news or on the news. Lots of people talk about us, and this is us talking about ourselves.
The kind of things that people say don't touch, we are going to go there.
I mean, I think Jews and Muslims are talking about these things, but I think they're not talking about them together because they're worried that if they do, sparks might fly. A Muslim and a Jew go there.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.